Now, we're going to go to break in a minute. I want to segue into my my guest, who's Niara Eisley. And I'm just going to tell you a story before we go to break. And this has to do with an interview that I did of a woman who was in the United States Air Force from 1978 to 1982, almost exactly the years that Niara was in the Air Force. This lady had a top-secret clearance. I don't know what she did. I do know that when she was discharged from the military out of Okinawa in 1982, she went through an extended debriefing period. I've occasionally talked about this. I'm just going to mention it here. Her debriefing period, she said to me, lasted an exceptionally long period of time. I think she said months. And it went through three phases. Phase one, she called counseling. That is, she sat across from a debriefing officer, and it was essentially, let's get your story straight. When you go to the rest outside world, you don't tell them you did this. You're going to tell them you did that. Get it? Got it. Good. Okay. Stage two was very, very unpleasant. Stage two, she was given sodium pentothal and tortured. And the whole idea was for interrogators to find out that if she were captured by Russians or North Koreans or whomever, or Chinese, and if she were tortured, what would she give up? What information was at risk? And then stage three, which she said was better than stage two. I didn't think so after she described it to me. Stage three was she was brought into a room. Men in civilian clothing were very nice to her. They sat her down in a chair. They put a helmet on her head. The helmet was attached by wires to a device, a machine, which had knobs and switches and whatnot, and they scrambled up her memory. They scrambled up her head. I asked her, you know, were you able to remember things before your time in the military? She said, I honestly can't say. That was literally what she said. But the point is, that was technology 1982. They had the ability to completely screw up her head, manage her memory. And even back then, this is before my first book was published. I was a nobody. No one knew who I was. I was just meeting this woman. She just gave me the story. What I wanted to know then and what I'd like to know now is how widespread is this type of nonsense? This is 30-plus years ago. You have to know that this has been done many times to our servicemen and servicewomen. That their men, their minds have been screwed with, their memories have been managed, and ask yourself just how criminal a behavior that is, and just how significant the political repercussions would be if this behavior were ever outed in a convincing way. My next guest, Niara Eisley, is going to be talking about that and many, many other things, all from her book, her excellent book, Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light. We're going to come back to her in a few minutes. I am Richard Dolan. Let's all smile and take a break. Catch you in a few minutes. Welcome back. I'm Richard Dolan. You're on KGRA Radio. I'm here with my guest, Niara Eisley. Before we get started, I just want to make a statement slash promo for something that I will be doing in about 3 weeks now, and this is called the Modern Knowledge Tour. This is Canada's first nationwide tour on alternative information. The tour will be featuring myself, along with Michael Tellinger, who's another, one of the world's leading speakers, I guess we could say, in the alternative knowledge field. And a number of other individuals, Linda Moulton Howe will be there, Stanton Friedman will be there, among some of the more well-known UFO luminaries. Along with other experts dealing with subjects such as GMO foods, banking and corporate fraud, ET slash UFOs, government cover-ups, ancient archaeology, consciousness, occult symbolism, pyramid power, much, much more. This is going to be 11, possibly 12 cities across Canada from Halifax to Vancouver. We are going across the country in a big old RV, if you can believe it. It'll take about 3.5 weeks. I believe a lot of this is going to be YouTubed up, a lot of the trip. In other words, kind of like a video diary. But we're going to be doing 11 to 12 cities in Canada. If you are in Canada now, and if you're going to be in Canada in a month, last week of May, first 2 weeks of June, go visit www.modernknowledge2014.com. And you can get your tickets, and you can see the schedule and what cities are available and so forth. I have a guest here. I want to introduce her. I'm actually going to let her introduce herself for the most part, but this is a woman that I consider not simply a colleague but a friend. I've known her for, maybe close on 5 years now. We've had a couple of very, very excellent conversations. She knows that I have nothing but respect for her. She was in the United States Air Force from 1979, and she may correct me if I'm wrong, but I think until 1983. But she's had a lot of other interactions with the U.S. military, and she'll be able to tell you about that. And I think one other thing I want to say about this particular book that she's written, it's a brand new book. It's called Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light, subtitled A Journey of Spirit Retrieval and Awakening. I'm a very critical reader of the UFO library that's out there, and I receive manuscripts myself all the time. I am a small-time publisher. So I'm always sort of mentally ranking books as in terms of the readability and how well they're put together and organized. And I have to say, this is really a very fine book. Niara Isley is a really good writer. She's organized. She knows how to put her thoughts together. This sounds so unusual, but many people in this field, they go self-published route, and they don't know how to do it. And Niara is not simply a extremely insightful person, but she's actually totally coherent and a good writer, and she knows how to tell her story in a way that's very compelling. I found myself reading this book and not putting it down, and it's absolutely fascinating, riveting. So I'm very proud and happy to have Niara Isley. Niara, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Richard, and thank you for that wonderful build up on my book. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's absolutely heartfelt, and I just want people to know the book is available on Amazon.com. You can look it up, Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light. There are 11 reviews on Amazon right now. They are all exceptionally positive. So you've got a lot of readers who are being quickly won over and very enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. You don't get that every day with a book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten very, very great feedback, not just on Amazon, but from emails, people that are reading the book. They're all saying they can't put it down, and that's exactly what a writer wants to hear.
Absolutely.
So that's cool. Mm-hmm.
And also, now, I mean, we'll be getting into your specific experiences, which include encounters with human and non-human abductors, and among many other things. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, this book can count as part of the MILAB library, you know, books that deal with military abductions. And on that basis alone, I would have to say this is one of the very top books that's ever been written on that subject. There are a couple of other people who have had military abduction experiences, and their works are important. But I think this book takes its place immediately as a must-read for anyone who has an interest in this phenomenon, which we call military abductions.
Mm-hmm. So, I wrote the book primarily for my own healing. I mean, I was shushed by friends and family for so many years. Please don't talk about those weird experiences. They're too far outside the box. And so for a long time, I tried to do that. You know, in fact, when my memories first came back in 1994, mm-hmm. I kind of laugh about this now, but back then I said, geez, if I ever go public with this, the only job I'm going to be able to get is speaking at UFO conferences.
Pretty much, right? Exactly.
Here I am. You know, but it took me 14 years. You know, 14 years I dug in my heels and said, no, I am not going public. But the whole time I was putting together all my research, because I was just driven to find out what the heck is this about? Why did it happen? And what political and social context could it possibly happen? And I was just trying so hard to figure that all out during those 14 years.
Well, in reading your book, I just found that you had a perspective that, at least for me, was completely compatible with my own perspective on pretty much everything there. And one of the phrases that I know that you use in this book was paradigm shattering, which mm-hmm. is a concept that I've often thought of in connection with this entire strange, crazy subject of UFOs and ETs. And when one gets involved in a field that is paradigm shattering, which this is, and your experiences are paradigm shattering, mm-hmm. you know, it's very hard, isn't it, to kind of have your feet in both worlds very easily. You're either in one or the other, it seems to me. And it looks like that, you know, you've had to make that decision yourself.
Well, I have had a foot in both worlds, but the foot on 3D planet Earth hasn't been the most comfortable one. because, you know, people just don't want to accept these experiences. And I took, you know, basically a fairly scientific approach to investigating my experiences from a layperson standpoint. I thought, okay, I have these weird and terrifying memories now from this hypnosis session with Bud Hopkins. What am I going to do with it? And I thought, okay, well, I didn't want to believe it either, because nobody, when they're confronted with that kind of abuse, wants to believe that other human beings can be that inhumane to another one of their own kind.
Well, let's start. I'm sorry to jump in, but I'm actually itching to get going. And I think people listening really want to hear you talk about your story.
Sure.
In recounting your life experiences here, there are a couple of key events that really seem to stand out. You talked a bit about an event when you were a very small girl, age 4, and you have some recollection of that. You talked about as a very young woman around the age in your early 20s when you were married to a gentleman in Germany. He was in the military, and you had it was a very unusual experience there.
Oh, yes.
And I'd love it for us to talk about that. And then you had and how that whole memory came back. And then you had an experience, of course, when you were in the United States Air Force at the Nevada test site, in which you lost 3 months of time.
Yes.
3 months of time.
At least 3 months.
So I don't know what you're most comfortable starting with, but I would love for us to be able to get into all of that. And I think that there's a lot of other issues that are going to come naturally in the wake of those. I guess I would ask you, an instinct's leading me to the time when you were in your early 20s, you're in Germany, and I wonder if you might describe this. How would you like to describe it? How would you like to tell the story of your life? Maybe I should just let you do that.
Yeah.
Why don't you just go?
Okay. I did want to say that with my experiences, I know some of them are really fantastic, so I went out and I gathered all kinds of data, thinking I would find data that would either support them or not support them. And I found way more data that supported my experiences than not.
Okay.
So why I kind of wanted to start with that, so that people understand that I didn't just latch on to all of this stuff and run with it. I had to be convinced myself.
I would just say, jumping in, that having now spent some time with you on a number of occasions and gotten to know you to some reasonable extent, that I would think that anyone who really meets you and gets to know you would trust your judgment and know that you're someone of integrity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as far as starting, things started in childhood. That dream at 4 years old where I was taken out and put under a street lamp, that was a big red flag for Bud Hopkins, because when people are under a light, they're usually being examined by these grays with the big eyes, and indeed that was what was happening, and I was really terrified.
Can you describe this a little more for people who are listening?
When I was I remembered before the hypnosis was having this horrible nightmare where my big sister, who was 12 years older than me, took me, a little 4-year-old, out in the middle of the night. And she had two friends with her, and I could not see the friends' faces. I couldn't see who they were. They were just kind of shadowy. And she took me out in the middle of the night, and she left me alone under a street lamp on a very dark street. And she said, "Stay here until I come back for you." And so I said, "Okay." And I stayed there, and I stayed there, and I stayed there. And she didn't come, and she didn't come. And then finally, I got so scared, I just started screaming. And then I woke up in my bed screaming. So that was the memory that I had. I told Bud about it because it had really stuck in my mind. And so when we looked at it, actually that was an abduction. I remember saying under hypnosis, "Wow, it's nighttime and the bedroom is full of light," you know, because there was all this light coming in the window. And then I was levitated right out of the bed through the ceiling, into the craft. And there I underwent some kind of examination with something that resembled an ultrasound in the abdominal area.
Yes.
And I can only assume, from what I've studied of the phenomenon and the hybridization program, is they were checking out my female organs. to see if they were what was needed for their research purposes. Now,
did you ask your sister about, I mean, did you ever conclude that she was or was not actually involved in the abduction itself?
I never was able to do that, and my sister is a very different individual to me, and it's not something I would be very comfortable to approach her about.
I can appreciate that. I will share with you, I did an interview with a gentleman who is in his early 60s, and he's a great guy, and told me of his own childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. In which he was about 4 or 5 years old, about the age that you were, and he had an older kind of a cousin, not quite a sister, but like that. She was in her mid-teens. So again, this is very similar to your sister. And, he said he used to remember she would come in his room in the middle of the night and say, okay, we're going outside now to the school bus. And in his backyard, there would be, at night, in the middle of the night, there'd be the school bus, but it wasn't a school bus. Huh. And he would go on a ride. And he had these very explicit memories of being taken to a place in this, quote, bus, which was not a bus. And what he was obviously having were very bizarre experiences where he was unable to see the faces of the people that were talking to him. He said he was only able to look up to basically the knee or the waist level, and he was not able to see their face. And he had a series of these. And when you're describing your own experiences, mm-hmm. couldn't help but think of this other individual. I just have to think, you know, I'm wondering, is there some broader pattern that at least at that particular time was going on? This man's a little bit older than you, but it's a kind of a similar general time period here. And mm-hmm. I have to wonder if there was some kind of program where siblings were used, whether in reality or in one's mind, mm-hmm. you know, to take these little kids out and to kind of test them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could be because, you know, I trusted my sister. My sister, you know, we had a crazy kind of alcoholic codependent family, and I'm very much a true starseed in that I'm like the cuckoo, you know, who went and laid her egg in a nest and then flew off and left the baby to be raised by a different family. Uh-huh. I'm definitely very much like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So my family is so different for me. I mean, it's a difference of night and day. So anyway, I just throw that in there. And my sister, I would just have to say that if my sister had really been on a ship, I kind of think she wasn't. I think they were just using an image of her because I remember seeing her standing on a ship and she looked so calm. And I'm thinking, if she was standing in this real place, she would not be calm.
Okay.
And that was my first clue that something was not quite kosher with my sister's image on the ship.
Right, right. I mean, unless, of course, they just calmed her down in their own way.
That's possible.
Yeah, you never know. Mm-hmm. It's really quite fascinating. So you remembered this event from very early on, and it did require some regression years later with Bud Hopkins. You included the transcripts of a number of these regressions, and I must say, when they, you know, people want to criticize the efficiency of abductions or the accuracy of regression, mm-hmm. I didn't get the idea in any of these transcripts that you were being led in any way by the person conducting the regression. It just mm-hmm. seemed to me that what they were able to do for you is to put you in a greater state of relaxation, just so that you were able to remember things. Is that your sense?
That was my sense. And hypnosis is an unusual process where sometimes when you're under hypnosis, you just feel like you're deeply relaxed and, you know, partially asleep. But you say these things and it just kind of moves up out of the subconscious. And sometimes the subconscious will put things out that the conscious mind will go, what? Are you kidding? Yikes. You know? I need to
I always feel careful. I feel cautious with some regression testimony. I do.
Yeah.
I do have some experience, at least in studying this, in which it seems to me that some of these regressions can be confabulated. I think it's absolutely possible that it can be. On the other hand, you have to wonder when someone comes up with something that is of such detail and such, such logical detail, which actually is the case with your regression transcripts.
Yeah.
I think we have to acknowledge the likelihood that you're, you know, the person's recalling something that actually did happen. Certainly it can be the case that it's accurate.
Well, again, applying at least, you know, some scientific method, what comes out of the hypnosis session, it's a block of information. And then you take that information and you start looking, well, is there correlating data? Are there other experiences and other testimony that say similar things? Because if there is, then it needs a serious look. If there isn't correlating testimony or other data out there in support of what you've said, then you need to toss it out, whether you believe it or not.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what's next of importance in your, as you're retracing your life and the weirdness and the experiences that you've had, where do you think you want to go next with this?
Where to go next? Well, the experience, I'll go ahead and dive into that experience that we were talking about Germany.
Yeah.
That was, because this is kind of controversial and this is probably difficult for a lot of people to talk about, but I'm a little more comfortable talking about it because I've led workshops in healthy sexuality and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me from all my experiences and research and reading and that I was used as a person to help the hybridization program. And it seemed like I was also being used to collect data on human sexuality. Mm-hmm. And the Grays, I think, did things to make me a little bit more highly sexed individual. And then I think that they have implants or had implants in me to take readings of neuropeptide levels, hormone levels, all the different neurological and emotional and chemical things that go on in the body during a sexual experience. I think they were collecting all that data so that as they were working on their hybrids and hooking up the genetics just so, that their hybrids would come out with the correct feeling, emotion, and motivation, physical motivations to sexually perform.
Got it.
And so this instance in Germany that we were discussing was, you know, I was in bed, still asleep. My husband had gone to work. He was in the army in Germany. And, he's
1975,
gone.
I think it, right?
Yeah, I think about then. And yeah. So I'm asleep in the bed and I woke up having an absolutely explosive orgasm all by myself in the bed, no nothing going on, just waking up, boom. And I looked around the bedroom and my face was beet red. I was just laying there in bed embarrassed that I had had such an experience all alone in my own bedroom. And I was blown away. I thought, what on earth happened, you know? And I was having a dream at the time of this Rudolph Valentino chic character from, you know, that comes striding into the tent, you know, in those old silent movies. And I just thought, what on earth? You know, and I always wondered about it. And then later on, as I got more memories back from hypnosis and started researching, it took years, but you know, I began to connect the dots and just put it together that if they're doing a hybridization program, then they probably need study and research subjects to make sure that their hybrids are, put together the right way.
Right. But you, at the time you had kind of a vague, kind of visual of what your dream, let's call it a dream, mm-hmm. was, but then years later you went through a regression on this and what did you uncover?
What I uncovered was, I was asleep in the bed and I was having an experience where, there was sexual contact between me and a hybrid being that was going on, and then an actual gray, and not a hybrid, but a gray, was actually floating over me and observing me while I was going through the sexual experience. You know,
correct.
You
described the hybrid as I'm recalling, with very dark eyes, but then it would seem to, like, change appearance. It was almost as if it was kind of creating some illusion for you. That's the impression.
Well, it could. Yeah, they were extremely vivid blue eyes, and you know, kind of dark blue.
Okay.
And he was something. He did seem to have just a shred or two of emotion, and he seemed to sense when I was uncomfortable, and he would kind of put a hand on me somewhere in kind of a comforting gesture.
But he didn't seem in your recollection, in the hypnotic mm-hmm. recollection, that mm-hmm. he was like this absolute hunk movie star that woman would want to. But he had an ability mm-hmm. to create intense arousal.
Yeah, he did have an ability to do that, and you know, definitely not a hunk. In fact, that gave me another kind of issue, which is, you know, when sex feels good, you just want to go for it.
Right.
But when you're with a being that's not human and looks very strange and very different from a normal human man, you know, it's like it's like 1 foot on the brake and 1 foot on the accelerator. You want to go with the good feeling, but your other foot is saying, put on the brakes here because this isn't a human.
This is bizarre. Well, hold that thought. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to go to a break here, but I want to come back to this and continue with this, and then we'll keep moving on to some of your other experiences and draw some conclusions. I'm Richard Dolan. I'm here with Niara Eisley, author of the new book, Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light. This is the Richard Dolan Show on KGRA Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Richard Dolan here with Niara Eisley. We're just having a riveting discussion on her new book, Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light. This is about her experiences with human and non-human abductors and encounters of that type. During the break, we were talking about whether we were going to entertain call-ins, and we're not going to be doing that tonight, unfortunately. However, Niara, you said that there is on your website a place for people to kind of congregate and to talk about these issues?
Yeah, people can go to my website. Right now I'm still trying to kind of catch up my home life with after the book work because, you know, I wrote the book and the home kind of went to hell.
Understood.
So now
that.
It's time
I
to pay
that.
The piper and clean up the house. But I do have a group on Facebook called Conversations About Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light. And it's for people that have read the book that have questions, because there's a lot of material I introduce in the book that I know people are going to have questions about and they're going to want me to elaborate on. And so I will be posting answers. I may even do a YouTube that answers several questions, you know, verbally that people can watch. And then my website is facingtheshadowembracingthelight.com. And I will be developing that as an educational website. And then my other website is called Encounters with Healing, and that is for people who are like myself, who have had experiences with trauma and are looking for trauma recovery work. I have several certifications.
Excellent, excellent. Mm-hmm. I would encourage people to go visit those pages. And I'm guessing that the Facebook page might be particularly active and probably a lot of engaging people there. And this is a 500-page book, by the way. It's really substantial, and it's packed. You don't 500 pages without pictures, so there's a tremendous amount of really fascinating information in this book. And before we continue on, because I do want to come back to your experience from 1975 in Germany when you had this apparent sexual encounter with a hybrid being. Mm-hmm. This whole idea of trauma. Mm-hmm. It's been a very big concern of mine for a number of years now that, you know, what we're dealing with in this very bizarre phenomenon, which is really at the very edge of what our comprehension and understanding allows us to get, that we struggle to grasp it, that one of the problems, one of the biggest problems we have is that people are having these encounters that are often traumatizing, sometimes transformative, sometimes both. Mm-hmm. You know, in both negative and positive connotations, but that they have to deal with it and they have to process it alone. And to me, that's one of the great crimes of what our society does to people, in that we're so constrained to talk about these experiences, which are the most fundamental, profound experiences that most people go through, and they can't talk about it with anyone. And you had to deal with that yourself.
Yeah. For many years, I had to deal with it alone.
Yeah. It's so difficult, and I just think so wrong.
Yeah.
And you have a lot to say on that. It's very obvious that in the course of your own life and your own thoughts on this, that this comes through. And I think for people who are experiencing something that they think they may be dealing with, right? Not sure. I really think that your book, in addition to providing knowledge, I think also it's a much needed and useful bit of moral support for a lot of folks. So I hope they read it for that reason as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my hope as well. I hope it would give people who've had experiences like mine at least a beginning map to recovery. And they can always contact me if they want to work with me personally, or at least just even talk to me. Because sometimes deep listening to someone who has gone through something, that can be as healing for the person as any therapy. Just that deep listening and allowing them to be heard, truly heard.
Yeah, very well said. Mm-hmm. So can we return to this idea of sexuality?
Sure.
You had this experience in the mid-70s. You were a young woman at the time. So, I mean, you were, you know, in a very, very highly sexual state of your life at that point, mm-hmm. I assume.
Yeah.
But somehow it was amped up.
Mm-hmm. It was amped up.
This experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, can you just talk a little bit more about that? Like, what was happening to you and how that affected your life? I think I got the impression you felt it affected your life in a very negative way, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yeah, it did. Because, let's see. Well, let's talk alcoholism for a minute, okay? Mm-hmm. Alcohol or drugs, you know, that's the drug that people get addicted to it and they want to continue to have that because it's a great stress reliever. Well, people can form the same thing, the same problem with sex, you know, and it's sex addiction. And there's 12-step groups for this and everything else like that. But the thing with sex addiction is you develop a relationship with your own sexuality where you're using it to relieve stress, just like taking a drink of alcohol. And this can lead to some extremely dysfunctional behavior. I'm lucky that I didn't go too far down that path. What I did do was bad enough. And as I wrote in the book, you know, going into that area of my life is not the purpose or in the scope of the book. But there were things I did that I regretted and had to look at my behavior and had to turn things around. But I also have to say here that I kind of ran hot and cold. There were times when there was a lot of sexual acting out, that I was unconscious of what was motivating it or what was pushing it. And then there were other times when I just completely shut down sexually.
Interesting.
It was like, don't come near me. I don't want you to even think about it. Just leave me alone.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you feel that this had a relationship to your experiences, and that's the impression that I'm getting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, when you go into therapy, they look for early childhood experiences that set you up for this kind of behavior. And I didn't have any experiences really with any human beings, but I did have these experiences as a child. Even as a child, there was a point in the Bud Hopkins hypnosis session where he turned off the tape recorder because he felt this was too sensitive to put on the tape recorder. But he said, but we looked at a part of my experience where one of the grays was actually putting something on me, on the genital area when I was just a little girl to create this, feeling of sexual sensation when I was just a child. Now, if a human being did that, it would be called sexual molestation. And I guess it still is, even if a gray does it. But I don't think the grays really had in mind that they were doing something, malevolent.
Right. You made a very good distinction in your book about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When a human being abuses a child sexually, there is definitely a malevolence to it. And that was absent with the grays.
Yeah. I mean, because a human being knows that he or she is doing something that's illegal and goes against moral codes, which you made very clear. And right, you were stating that the grays, or the Zetas, I think you were calling them.
Yeah.
They don't really seem to have that. So there's not this necessarily malevolence. we can still consider it wrong and manipulative, but it's not quite the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting distinction that you made.
Well, I think those distinctions are very important, you know, because, you know, there's emotion, there's emotional energy you get from another human being that was definitely either absent completely or very much muted down from the other beings, you know, from the Zetas and the hybrids.
And as I recall, you had seen a therapist before you were doing regression, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but that individual suggested that you might have been sexually molested. Mm-hmm. But then when you looked at your family, like you said, you knew your father had not done anything, or like no. anyone that you knew had done anything like that, so that ruled all that whole part out.
Yeah, Yeah, my father was many things, but he was not a child molester, and he and I were fairly close despite his alcoholism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just on a personal note, I actually really enjoyed reading your description of your relationship with your dad in the sense that, you know, I mean, I'm a father, so I have two teenagers, and believe me, I'm all too aware of the fact that we're all of us are imperfect beings, and relationships between children and parents always have some kind of problem. But it was obvious that you really love your dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was probably, of all the people in my family, he was probably the most kindred spirit to me, and I still miss him. I mean, he died when I was in my early 20s, and I still miss him so much to this day.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think he'd be really proud of me today.
Well, it was very touching to read that. And it was just a nice feature of the writing that you're brave enough to talk about these. I mean, these are very personal experiences, Niara.
Yeah.
So I really want to thank you for having the courage to reach down there and to talk about them the way you do.
Well, for other people, you know, if other people are dealing with similar things that because of the nature of the material, they've been afraid to talk about it, somebody has to break the silence. And I thought, well, I'm pretty good at doing this, so it might as well be me. So it's out there.
Indeed. So let's jump ahead a little bit to your time in the Air Force. Do you mind?
Mm-hmm. No, not at all.
So you enlisted in the Air Force, I think, in 1979.
Yes.
So you were in your mid late 20s, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mid 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's up with the fact that you can't remember all this time? I mean, just talk a little bit about being in the Air Force and then you met your second husband there.
Yeah.
And you can't almost remember anything about that.
I know. That was really weird. Bud pointed that out to me and I thought, "Yeah, that is weird. That is really strange."
Can you describe this for people listening what we're talking about here?
Yeah. Okay. So I went into the Air Force in 1979. I went to boot camp at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, and then I went to to technical training school at Keesler Air Force Base near Biloxi, Mississippi. I was there during Hurricane Frederick, and then I went home for the holidays for Thanksgiving and Christmas and had some leave. Then I was stationed at Nellis. And I remember arriving at Nellis, and I remember, you know, starting the whole indoctrination to the base, that process. And then I remembered working at Tonopah, but that's when I got kind of scared. And I was talking to a friend about 10 years after I got out of the military, and for some reason, it was just such a big blank spot in my mind, I just never really went back there until somebody specifically asked me about my military time.
I just want to jump in. I don't want to take this, but for people who are listening, if they're not aware, when you mention Nellis and you mention Tonopah, we're now talking about Nevada. We're talking about the Nevada test site. We're talking about proximity to, famously, Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to get that out there. And so if someone, and this is where the weirdness and the missing time did happen. So I just want to get that out there. So keep going.
Okay. So, when this friend asked me, and again, 10 years after getting out of the military, he said, "Tell me about your military time from beginning to end." And I said, "No problem." And then I started relating what I just told you. But then when I got to the part where I worked at Tonopah, I just looked at him and I thought, "I can't tell you anything. I can't remember anything about working at Tonopah. And I worked there for 3 months or more. I can't remember my coworkers. I can't remember the duty station. I can't remember the compound. I can't remember any of the stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't even remember the name of the motel I stayed at every other week." That's and I have a really good memory. And when it doesn't work, It's a big red flag. And with this realization of...
And yet you'd gone for years without even realizing that you couldn't remember.
Yeah. But when I realized I couldn't remember, that's when I felt that nausea. I just felt sick to my stomach. I didn't actually throw up, but I did feel sick to my stomach with fear.
Exactly.
And, Mm-hmm.
So you had to go through this process of trying to reconstruct or recover those mm-hmm. memories.
Yeah.
And I guess we should just point out, you mentioned Bud Hopkins a few times, and of course Bud recently mm-hmm. passed away, famous abduction researcher. You met Bud Hopkins in 1994. You were at a conference at the time, and that's when you ran into him. And that's really what was a big transformation of your life. And then
it was.
You started going through these regression sessions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what happened when, you're aware now, I can't remember how I, the early phase of when I met my second husband, and I can't remember what the hell I did when I was working there. So how did you reconstruct or recover these memories?
How did I reconstruct the memories?
And what did you remember?
I had experiences. It was a long time between hypnosis with Bud Hopkins was 1994, and the next time I went under hypnosis, I was reeling from shock all those years. And the next time I went under hypnosis was with Gloria Hocker in 2003, and she's an experiencer of both ET experiences in my lab also. Mm-hmm. And I trusted her enough to go under because after being with Bud, who I did trust him, it was like, oh my God, this, I'm just, like I said, I was just reeling in shock. I was scared to investigate and yet driven to investigate. And I thought, okay, I can't accept this. I just can't accept this.
Yeah, your hypnosis, your regression with him gave you enough to know that there was something very important going on, but not every detail.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so I thought, well, if this is real, there will be other people out there that have similar stories to tell. And so I went and I looked and I talked and I went to lectures and I went to talks and I read books and I went everywhere. And to my horror, I found more corroborating testimony than not.
So what do you remember now of mm-hmm. the missing time or the time mm-hmm. that was missing?
Mm-hmm. What I've gotten back from hypnosis was that I was taken out in the middle of the night. This is started with Bud. I was taken out in the middle of the night to test the radar that I worked on, which was a surface air missile radar.
And you were at the Tonopah Electronic Warfare Range, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
And so I was taken out in the middle of the night at gunpoint in no uncertain terms. Were we to speak to each other? We had about three people on the crew, the radar crew, and we were, again, taken out there at gunpoint. We were given fatigues to wear with no rank insignia and no name tags. We were forbidden to speak to each other beyond what was necessary to run the radar and do the test of the aircraft. And then when it was over, we were told to stand out on the deck of the radar van and be quiet. And when we were standing out there, we looked up in the sky, and the special aircraft that we had been tracking were saucers and other extraterrestrial and/or back-engineered craft.
And we're talking roughly, 1980 or so, right?
Yeah, 1980, yes. Yeah. January of 1980.
Exactly. So you saw a number, if I'm recalling, maybe up to nine of these basically flying saucer-type craft. And I think you said that the radar equipment that you guys had was really unable to keep up with these objects.
No. Yeah,
I mean, they're just
zipping
around.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way.
Yeah, no way.
And if someone asked you, what do you think you saw? And you said, I think we're looking at UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a UFO. And they were, they were pretty unpleasant, laughing in a very unpleasant way because, they had us under control, with guns and mm-hmm. intimidation and things like that. So when they were done at the radar, they put us on a bus with painted over windows and took us to what I believe was either Area 51 or possibly an underground facility mentioned by William Pollack at Tonopah. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure either place because the windows were painted over. I was taken into a medical facility. All of the people that were out there that night were put in this medical facility We were sat down in a waiting room. The lights were turned off in the waiting room. I imagined to help with memory, lack of memory retrieval. And one by one, they called us into this little side room. And when it was my turn to go in there, I was told to lay down fully clothed on a stainless steel examining table. There was a security guard in the room with me with a sidearm standing at parade rest. And then this guy comes in and says, "Stay calm," three times in a real monotone voice. And when he walks up beside the right side of my head, he interjected me in the side of the neck with one smooth move like he'd done it 100 times. And the chemical went straight to the brain, and my whole body just went into shock. And then from there, two security guards appeared on either side of me, on either side of the table, lifting me up by the arms, getting me off the table, and taking me down this staircase. At the bottom of the staircase, I was thrown in a little room while people watched while I went through the effects of the injection. And that has puzzled me for a lot of years, and I have an intuitive insight on it, but I would need more data to corroborate whether it's true or not. But I'm guessing that they put me in that room and isolated me from everybody else because whatever was in that injection might have had an effect that would spill over onto other people.
What do you mean by that? First of all, what do you think these effects were on you that people were observing? And what do you mean in the sense that they would spill over onto other people?
Well, there's all this talk about ascension in the world right now. Okay, there's going to be this spiritual ascension and everything else like that. And I'm sure on the surface the government really poo-poos that. But the people in the deep covert op programs are probably thinking, okay, what's going on here? Is there going to be some kind of dimensional shift and everything? And I really have a pretty strong intuitive hit now that the injection they gave me was to try to chemically create an ascension dimensional shift rather than doing it through natural spiritual evolutionary process.
Doesn't it make more sense to you that the chemical they injected with would be to just screw with your memory?
It could be, but again, why put me in an isolated room?
Yeah, I don't know.
That I didn't know. I didn't really understand that. I don't have the answers. I'm just saying what the intuition was.
How did you react after you were injected with this? Did you convulse, or were you just groggy, or do you remember?
It wasn't like convulsions. It was more like just suddenly just being struck solid or still. When they put me in the room, I remember I kind of curled up on the floor because I felt like I was coming apart. I felt like I was going to dissolve and run down the drain or something.
Oh, gosh.
It was really, and the weirdest thing was it wasn't painful. It just felt like this just really, really intense tingle all the way through the whole body.
And it sounds like it had a physiological effect in that sense, but it also had an effect on your brain chemistry, obviously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I would have to think that part of it was designed to manage and control and wipe your memory.
Yeah, I'm certain that was part of it. And as far as memory wiping, after I had hypnosis with Bud Hopkins, I remember thinking, you know, and I've given myself a very, very good scientific education. And so I was thinking, how on earth could they go into the human brain and zap neurons and encapsulate or isolate blocks of memory? How would they do that? And just even describing that, okay? So this is 1994 or 95 when I'm trying to sort all this out. 2005, two movies came out. One was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and the other one was Paycheck.
Yeah.
And both of them dealt with exactly the kind of technology that I imagined was used on me to isolate my memories and block them out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
that's more than coincidence. Yeah, I think that's more than coincidence.
Niara, did you hear, before you came on, I described a story of a woman that I had interviewed who was in the Air Force almost the exact same time that you were.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you didn't hear it, I'm going to tell it to you real quickly.
Uh-huh.
Did you hear this?
I don't think so, no.
No, okay, so we're going to go to a break in a minute, but I'm going to tell you the story, then we'll go to break, and we maybe we can reconvene here. But so before I wrote my, before I finished my first book in the late 90s, I met with a woman who had been in the U.S. Air Force from 1978 to 1982. So she was exactly a year ahead of you in that. She did some kind of top secret work. I don't know what it was, but she was discharged out of Okinawa in 1982. And long story short, her debriefing lasted a long, long time. She said weeks, possibly months. And she described three specific phases of her debriefing. In phase one, it was simply, she called counseling, where there's a debriefing officer who basically said, you're going to get your story straight. You're not going to tell the world you did this. You're going to tell me you did that. And that apparently lasted a while. Phase two, she said, was very unpleasant, and in that she was forced to take sodium pentothal and essentially subjected to what she called hostile interrogation. Basically, she was tortured under this drug to find out if she were captured, what would she give up, what information and so forth would be vulnerable. That was apparently really, really not fun for her, as I could imagine. Mm-hmm. And then in phase three, she said, I was brought into a room with guys in civilian clothing. I sat down. They put a helmet on my head, which was connected by wires to a machine that had knobs and switches. And basically, the way she described it is they scrambled up her head with this type of helmet, maybe through electromagnetic means rather than chemicals, although who knows, chemicals might have been used as well. But that was 1982. Mm-hmm. And I will just say that this lady was eminently credible, in my opinion, due to the whole context of my interaction with her. And my immediate thought was, how widespread is this phenomenon going on? How many other people and servicemen and servicewomen have the U.S. military screwed the memories of?
Yeah.
And apparently, you know, it happened to her and it happened to you, and I've got to think it's happened to many, many people. We're going to go to a break right now. We're at the bottom of the hour. We have one more segment coming back. I'm Richard Dolan. I'm here with Niara Eisley, author of the new book, Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light. This is about Niara's experiences in the Air Force and in life. And she's had fascinating experiences and equally fascinating insights. We'll be back for one more segment. I'm Richard Dolan. This is KGRA Radio. Well, time always flies on this show, and I think especially so tonight. I'm here with Niara Eisley, who has been talking for the last hour. We're going to have her one more half hour relating to her book, Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light. Again, this is a book that is available on Amazon, but also on Niara's website. And Niara, could you just give the people your website again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my website is called facingtheshadowembracingthelight.com. And if you go there, you will see all the different versions of my book that's available. If you order it from me or from my Create Space storefront page, I get a little better royalty. So if you want to do that for me, that would be very wonderful. But mostly I just want people to read the book because I think it's going to just educate the public so much about this phenomenon in a very comprehensive way and a very solid way. So wherever you want to get it is fine with me. So
I would encourage people to go through the Create Space route. As a small publisher myself, I do know that's a nice little difference. And, the people who do this, and write a book and they try to make a little bit of money out of it. I've heard a number of people who almost in a sniping kind of way will criticize someone for thinking, oh, well, they're only in this for the money. And all I can think of is that is the most short-sighted perspective I can possibly imagine. Especially if someone decides to devote themselves to this topic, rather than go about it as a dilettante, then you've got to find a way to make it financially work. And you, Niara, deserve to make, everything that you can make on this. This is a very excellent, courageous book. Is it available as an ebook, by the way?
It's available as a Kindle edition, yeah.
Yeah, so it's an ebook. Mm-hmm. So excellent. So, if you have an e-reader, then you can get it in that way as well. So excellent. Mm-hmm. And again, I want to just emphasize, this is a nicely written book, and I can't say that about every new book in the alternative field that I read. So it's really refreshing to see someone who knows what they're doing with the word processor.
Yeah, thanks.
It's gratifying for me to read that.
Time as an English major paid off.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, it did. So we've got a little bit of time left, and I guess we've talked about some of the bizarre and out-of-the-ordinary experiences you've had from the time that you were a little girl, from the time that these apparent non-humans were manipulating your sexuality, to the time that you're in the Air Force. Now, here's an interesting thing. So you're in the Air Force here at Tonopah, and they're basically showing you a display of what appear to be flying saucers or UFOs. Now, the implication is, are these ours or not ours? Maybe you don't have an answer to that, but apparently the equipment that you were using was just not up to spec in terms of tracking these UFOs.
No, not at all. You have to track, an aircraft for at least 5 minutes for it to be considered a kill, with the surface air missile radar.
And, right, there was just no way you guys could do that.
No.
You know, the technology of 1980. So that's interesting. I'll tell you a story. This actually came to me from a Gulf War veteran that I interviewed a number of years ago. He had been in Operation Desert Shield. This is right before, this is in 1990. So he was stationed, he was a tank commander. He was in the Iraq desert. Before the war started, there were American units that were in the Iraq desert. And he was part of, I think he said Air Defense Command, is, you know, sounds crazy to me, but that's what he said he was in. And he said to me that his unit was told, or maybe his unit was told by Air Defense Command, that might have been it, to observe a certain portion of the sky in the next few days and observe. And he said, and sure enough, in the next couple of days, we saw, well, UFOs. I don't know what else he could describe them as. And he said, the thing is, had we tried to shoot them out of the sky, he said, we would have had no chance. I mean, these things were so vastly beyond anything that we knew how to deal with. And it's, again, it sounds very similar. And this is a story that I very seldom repeat. I don't think it's been out there. But it's very much in line with what you're describing, except he didn't go through the whole memory wipe thing, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
But they went and messed with you. So I guess my question for you is, in thinking of all of these, first of all, have you had continuing experiences over the past few decades that you would say are unusual?
Yeah, I have. I was living in Auburn, California as recently as like the late 1990s, and I was still waking up with strange bruises. I woke up with three tiny, looked like baby finger bruises on the inside of my thigh one morning. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty strange. So, you know, I still wake up with a bruise here and there. But the experiences seem to have shifted. And that's why I mention, I put these little things throughout my book, and I call them interacts.
Yeah.
And these memories are memories that are extremely vivid for me. They carry a powerful emotional charge. And they seem to be memories of living a different life on a different planet, which I identify as Lyra. And then I had this incredible experience. I mean, every so often, you remember Luke Skywalker when he was flying over the Death Star and Ben Kenobi was talking in his head with telepathy?
Yeah.
And he tapped the side of his helmet and think, gosh, Ben is dead. You know, I can't be hearing Ben, you know. Well, it was kind of like that for me for a long time. I would get these messages, and it would be like words, and I'd think, what is this? Where is it coming from? And then if it really wanted to get my attention, it would keep putting the same idea in there over and over. And then finally, I went down, and I just kind of confronted this whole thing at the American River Confluence near Auburn. And I sat down there by the rushing water, and I said, okay, are you guys really there? Are you, like, really talking to me? Yes, we're really talking to you.
It just came back that clearly.
It came back clear, and it's so fast that I barely get the question formed, and I barely get the first word of the question out of my mouth before the answer is coming back. And it's been very powerful, and I remember thinking, wow, so I could just check in with you guys, and I don't have to make any more stupid human mistakes in my life, right? And they said, no, that's not why you're here. We're here. You have to live your own life and bungle through. But we are here to teach you and to try to get you to look at what's important, what we think is important. And they have been true to that all this time. And they are not the Grays. and they are beings that they look very human, but they have bluish skin. And they're very loving people, very connected to the earth in the same way that Native Americans are. And I know people are going to say, oh, she's talking about the movie Avatar. But James Cameron, who made the movie, he made it from a dream that he had 20 years before about a planet and blue people and so on and so forth. So did he make a movie? Or did he have a memory of this same place?
He's working off. So when you have vision of these people who are blue, mm-hmm. you're seeing this in a dream form? Are you seeing this in a waking imagination form? Or is it just coming to you somehow?
It's like waking memory. It's like waking memory. And the first one that happened, and see, I have a theory about this. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with the concept of a microcosm going to a macrocosm.
I think that I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Maybe you could explain it.
Okay. So when we're, as an individual human being, if we're trying to remember something, usually memory is assisted by contextual people, places, and situations. Mm-hmm. It brings up things in your memory. And
sure.
I think that all of us as individual humans are part of a larger body of collective humanity. And with all the things going on the planet right now that may be strangely reminiscent of the last days of Atlantis, that I think that that's why so many people now are claiming to have memories surface of Atlantis and Lemuria. Because the contextual energy and things that are going on planet Earth right now are very similar to those end times of that civilization long ago. And if you believe in reincarnation at all, then we could be the same people coming back trying to work this through in a better way than happened in Atlantis.
Okay. Well, this also leads into what I think is a very spiritual element of your book and of your thought. And I would like to explore that in the time we have left. But even first, before that, I guess I would like to ask you, based on your experiences and your assessment of the situation at this point, what would you say is actually going on in terms of interaction with humanity by non-humans? So, like, who's here? Mm-hmm. Are there discernible agendas that you can get a bead on? What do you think is the interaction of various human groups with all of this? I mean, how do you see the whole thing is kind of fitting together? Who are the players?
Who are the players? That's a good question. I think that there is like a galactic federation of positive beings out there that are kind of watching the situation here and thinking, wow, how can we help without really interfering with their necessary growth process? Because humanity is really in a crucible right now that is going to force us to either grow and evolve or we're all going to go down. And I don't want us going down. I think humanity has incredible potential that they're only barely beginning to realize. And I really put this in my book. This is probably one of the most important things I put in my book. The only war going on this planet is a war against the expansion of consciousness. And every other thing that we see is a symptom of that. Because we're being attacked by fluoride in the water. Mm-hmm. All kinds of food and water additives are attacking the brain in general and the pineal gland in specific. And the pineal gland is the seat of the soul in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do not want that gland of enlightenment to turn on. Because once humanity becomes enlightened on a collective scale, we can change the whole game of this planet. If you've watched What the Bleep Do We Know, or if you've read Michael Talbot's The Holographic Universe, you realize that what we hold in our consciousness is what we see in the world around us. And these beings, whether you want to call them Illuminati, or whether you want to call them archons, or extra dimensionals, or whatever, they have come here, and they have been managing our consciousness down through the ages to create a version of reality from it that works for them and keeps us subject to them. So in the film The Matrix, the cables were actually attached to the human body, and the human body was used as a battery to feed this huge a virtual reality net into which all human beings were hooked into.
Right.
But in our world, we don't have the cables hooked to our body, but we have newspaper and with television and religious indoctrination and political indoctrination and all of this stuff. And what I want people to realize is all, if I can just wake them up to all the ways they've been indoctrinated, then we can pull our energy out of those indoctrination programs, and then we have all this energy that we can use collectively to make a better world. But we have got to learn to put our differences aside. And I'm not saying that anybody, that people have to give up who they are. I'm just saying that they need to learn to agree to disagree with other people in a friendly manner.
Yeah, I think that's, these are all excellent points, of course, and you know that I agree in the sense that the great struggle of our era is a struggle between, we can put it a number of ways, but the struggle between totalitarian control and freedom. And we can include as part of that freedom higher consciousness and an awareness of ourselves as a more, in a more mature way, as a, in a more mature phase of our existence, I guess, which I think we need to move to. I guess my question would be, in terms of this control group that is keeping human consciousness down, certainly there's a human elite that's involved in doing this. Do you think that there's a non-human elite also that's involved in doing this?
Yeah, I think there could be.
I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot. If you want to say I don't know, then it's perfectly fine.
Well,
I just didn't know if you had an opinion.
I do have an opinion. One of the things when I was writing my book, particularly part three and part of part two, I've been noticing down through the decades from like the Walter Cronkite era to the current era, and there's all kinds of stuff going on TV, movies, and television right now that people would have been outraged at back in the Walter Cronkite era. They would just be absolutely outraged, but now they accept it. And there's just so much extremity and intensity and, you know, I hate to say it, but like trailer trash talk, you know, on the airwaves.
Well, I mean,
now.
It's pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious. That's what the whole culture has devolved to.
Yeah, there's this bickering and fighting and it's all drama,
It's become dumbed down and, I think we can fairly say deliberately so. When you look at the Cronkite era, I enjoy watching some classic Alfred Hitchcock movies from the late 50s and early 60s. To me, that's American civilization at its absolute peak. Well-dressed people, intelligent, sophisticated, respectful, you know, that's all gone.
Yeah.
That's just all gone. Now we wear sweatpants and sneakers and, exactly.
So hanging out and everything. So,
right.
I know. So anyway, just trying to, you know, get people to understand the devolution that's happened in the last 20, 30, 50 years and what we've lost and what we need to get back. I think that it's really, really important. And I think there's so much, propaganda being put out now from government and everything else like that. It's like I wrote a chapter in the book called Reclaiming Freedom. People need to understand that freedom is inherent to who they are. It is not something that can be granted or taken away by the state.
Right. Right. And I like that aspect of the book. It's really like you've got two books in here, you know. You've got the book that really deals with your personal journey, but you have a lot to say about these relevant issues. And, I'm glad you did that. But it really is like it's a separate, almost.
Yeah.
I don't want to say totally separate because it's all related, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, the part one and part two of the book really help people understand my intense passion to make this world a better place and to try to give them some of these awakenings and insights that I've had as a result of taking this journey through life.
Niara, have you spoken with other more recent MILAB military abductees or other people who've gone through comparable experiences as yourself? I mean, do you get a sense that this is still going on? There's a lot of whistleblowers out there who make claims, and I just want to know if you've spoken to them and what your assessment is.
I think it is still going on, and I have spoken to many of them, and the thing is the techniques have become more refined and more diabolical because they're using brain and entrainment technology, you know, like sound and frequency to use that to program people. And if they combine that with trauma, then they get a level of conditioning that is probably harder to break.
Describe the trauma-based conditioning, if you would. We have a few minutes left, and I really think it's important.
Yeah. Trauma-based mind control conditioning is where trauma, a state of extreme trauma, is induced in a subject, because when you're in that state of trauma, you switch into a very easily programmable mode. And so they induce the trauma, they insert the program they want to insert, and you have the scarring on the brain, but because they've inserted maybe like a keyword to bring out a certain personality, this is for people that are messed with as children, because when you're traumatized as a child, then you can fracture into several different alternate personalities. They Sure. call it now dissociative identity disorder, and because it's dissociative. So people separate into personalities, or if they're programmed later in life, then someone could call them and just say a keyword into the phone, and suddenly you've triggered that other personality, or that alter, as it's called.
Written and about then, in yeah. the book The Manchurian Candidate back in the 50s, yes. and portrayed accurately in both of the versions of that movie from the early 1960s and then later in the 90s. That type mm-hmm. of thing was very accurately portrayed.
Yeah. And it really has its roots in Project Paperclip after World War II. Our country didn't want the Russians to get a hold of the German scientists from the Third Reich, so they brought them over here, scrubbed up their profiles, gave them American-sounding names in many cases, and put them to work for our government. And I really believe that these Nazis, who were still Nazi Party, still into that, I believe mm-hmm. that was the beginning of some subversion of our government from within.
Yeah, I think you're in large company on that belief set as well.
Yeah.
I think the important thing here that you're pointing out, and this cannot be stressed enough, is that the human mind and human memory can absolutely be managed and controlled to an extent that I think would shock a lot of people who don't really spend much time thinking about this. And not only that it can be controlled, but that mm-hmm. that programs within the U.S. military, we know. I mean, everyone's heard of MK Ultra, but that's the tip of the iceberg. These programs have existed at least in a full-flowered form since the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, over half a century now.
Right.
So the capability, and right, the technology has only gotten better. So you're talking about contemporary techniques of using sound, like mm-hmm. acoustic entrainment, or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, acoustic entrainment. I'm not going to mention the name of the program on the air because I don't want to do any damage to them or anything. But there is a program of brainwave technology out there that people use for positive things.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who made that brainwave technology, the founder, creator of it, he said that for the last level of that program, he actually had a friend take him into a CIA laboratory to record the last level, because they had the greatest, latest technology for brainwave entrainment in that laboratory.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
One of the things that you mentioned at one point in the book that I was very intrigued by in terms of managing memory is that you speculated, it seemed like it was a speculation,
mm-hmm.
of the ability to kind of change our brain waves from like alpha to beta to theta and delta.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, because we have a certain type of brain wave that we use in normal waking consciousness, another in deep sleep, and another in REM sleep.
Right.
And that by modifying, if that ability exists to modify our brain waves, that would very much affect our ability to remember properly an experience that we're having,
Well, it could make it more dreamlike.
Exactly. Exactly.
But the ETs also use that. They also manipulate brain waves. And
sure.
And it's kind of how they accomplish some of what they do as well. So I'm guessing there has probably been a little technology or information transfer between at least some groups of grays in our military on that.
Right. I mean, all with the purpose of promoting confusion in the subject mm-hmm. so that they're not really able to remember correctly. All of that makes sense. So I'd like you to finish up by talking about some of the more spiritual insights you got. One thing that you said that I thought was very, very apropos was you said, it gives you I'm paraphrasing here, but that one gets a lot more strength in fighting injustice. Mm-hmm. If we realize that we have this non-physical aspect to our being, that we're more than just a bag of bones and wrapped in some skin.
Right. Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. And I urge people in the book to study about near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences so that they can understand that they really are not their body. They just inhabit it. And it's really, you know, where I was coming from, because in order to write this book, you know, I put a lot of information in it. A lot of information is out there now. And I, you know, I'm talking about some sensitive things that happened to me in the military. And so in order to write the book, I kind of had to make peace with my own mortality, you know, in case somebody mm-hmm. got pissed off for me to write this book. So I kind of did that.
Right.
And I'm still here. But I have to say that writing the book and making this statement and getting beyond the fear to get the statement out has brought me, I wouldn't say I'm completely at peace, but I am way more at peace than I used to be.
It's empowering, though, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
You know, you find your voice, and I mean, I understand this because, I mean, we're really living the same type of a life, and you find strength. And I would just encourage anyone listening right now who feels that they have an important story to tell, or if they're struggling to find their story, really find a way to put it down, because even if you never publish it as a book, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, you can publish it as a book, but what you're really doing is you're battling. It's your own titanic battle, and by getting that story down, you're empowering yourself. And I think you'll find strength inside yourself that you never knew. And then if you do go public, that's a scary thing to do, but you end up finding that strength. It's there. It's inside you all along. And Niara, that's exactly what you did.
Yeah, it pretty much is. And I would encourage everybody that's had experiences to create a timeline, like from birth to where they are currently, and then start writing down on that timeline at the appropriate places little events that have happened that they're trying to sort out, and then start to write it all down. Because when they write it down, more things are going to come out in their memory and more dots will connect. And it doesn't matter if you're going to publish it as a book or just share it with a good friend. There's going to be healing for you in that.
It's really, really good advice. Mm-hmm. Well, we're at the top of the hour. We've actually gone through our interview, Niara. I just want to thank you. It's been wonderful. And I know, I mean, I've just gleaned the chat room, but I mean, people really are enjoying this, and I've gotten some private communications that are raving about everything you've had to say. I really feel that you've gotten to, you've put yourself in a position where you're going to continue to be an inspiration for a lot of people out there. Absolutely. I know people knew about you before, but yeah, this book is, really going to cement you into a certain position. And like it or not, you're going to be in a position where a lot of people are going to be looking to you mm-hmm. for leadership and for, insight. But I think that you're absolutely up to it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I'm working very hard to make myself be ready for that.
Well, mm-hmm. got to clean up the house in the meantime, right?
Yeah. Still trying to clean up 4 years of mess here.
Well, I want to encourage people to visit the website of Niara Isley, her book, Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light. That's the website as well, facingtheshadowembracingthelight.com. Go there, check it out. She's got a Facebook page. There's a lot there, and, That's all we wrote for tonight. So I'm Richard Dolan. I've been with Niara Isley. We've had a wonderful conversation. I want to thank my producer, Race Hobbs, as always, for his excellent production work. I want to thank the people in the chat room for their support. And to you, the listener, for sticking with us. And I hope it's been a worthwhile couple of hours for you as well. I am Richard Dolan. When I'm not doing this show, I write about UFOs and ETs and everything else related to that. That's also my life. But until next week, by the way, I'm having a guest on next week. You'll hear about that. I'm Richard Dolan. This is KGRA Radio. Have a good one.